Greetings, North State. Just a reminder here to be sure and tune in to Common Ground Radio Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. You know, we have much more in common with one another than we normally recognize, but fail to see this thanks to our polarized media that deliberately divides us and demonizes the other side. Common Ground Radio is your progressive call-in talk show for the North State, right here on Radio KCNR, where we seek bipartisan agreement on many issues affecting all of us using respectful, fact-based dialogue and starting for change from the progressive side of the street. Good morning. You're listening to Common Ground Radio, where we present the political and social from the progressive side of the aisle. And we've got a great show today. We have Dr. Chad Hansen, who is an ecologist specializing in fire and how it affects us. Dr. Hansen is a co-founder of the John Muir Project, a scientist and an activist, and recognized by Leonardo Capaccio Foundation. And we're going to get to him briefly, and I'm going to go ahead and do my local news update first. And by the way, you are encouraged to call in area code 530-605-4567. But don't call in on the items expressed here in the news update. Today's broadcast is going to be on fire and how it affects Northern California. So if you're going to call in anything other than that, we'll save that for another show. So as you know, the truth is found in common ground. But you know what? The radicalized right doesn't care much about the truth. In fact, 53% of all Republicans, including local insurgent Doug LaMalfa, view Trump as the true president of the United States of America. That's just incredible. And 66% of Republicans asked say they want Trump again. They want, after losing in 2020, they want him back for 2024. And Trump and his Republicans just blocked a bipartisan commission to investigate Trump and his militias in their attempt to violently overthrow America during the January 06 insurrection. And, you know, I got to say, the Republican Party has been thrown under the bus, and it's now the Trump Republican Party. And here's a few things Doug LaMalfa and his white nationalist militia armies don't want you to know about. It's part of their opposition to what we call critical race theory education, or the truth. For instance, did you know that 100 years ago this week, white nationalists and militias attacked and committed genocide on the all-black neighborhood called Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma? This was one of the worst and well-documented episodes of white nationalist terrorism in U.S. history. 300 men and women and children were murdered, slaughtered, thousands injured, thousands incarcerated, and 35 square blocks demolished. You don't learn that in school, do you? No, you sure don't. And how about this? Did you know that on May 1st, 1868. Memorial Day was founded in the United States of America by black Americans and black Civil War veterans, just freed from slavery, basically creating an Independence Day for America's second revolution called the Civil War. Over 10,000 black people and black Civil War soldiers marched in a procession of mourning and remembrance, led by thousands of school children carrying roses and singing the Union Army's anthems of the Star Spangled Banner and John Brown's body, while hundreds of black women followed with baskets of flowers, wreaths, and crosses. In fact, according to many historians, African Americans basically won the Civil War for us, for the North, not for the South. But we're not taught this in schools. We're not taught about the origin. We're not taught about the origin of Memorial Day. In fact, the Civil War, it doesn't seem to be over, does it? Just 6 months ago, Trump and his white nationalist insurgents and militias stormed the United States Capitol, flying the great Grand Old Dixie Stars and Bars, in the worst attack on America since the Civil War, besides 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. Republicans and our local militias now embrace the South and their new Civil War as part of Trump's big lie. And just before we close, a year ago this week, George Floyd was lynched. He was murdered by a so-called peace officer. And that sparked a new awareness of what many African Americans have to go through daily in this nation. This nation founded on racism, slavery, oppression of people of color, and that continues right to this day. But we don't learn about that in our schools. And no, contrary to our local militia, his sheriff, the Black Lives Matter and Antifa did not storm Reading a year ago. That was just an alt-right fairy tale hoax and lie, an excuse for the local militia to display their armed-up white nationalism for Trump and our local Trumpist. Folks, we live in a racist society. Our nation and our county are both racist. Locally, the white nationalist supporters and Trump militias like the Jefferson State and the RWBM and gun dealer Patrick Jones, his sidekick Les Ball, continue to perpetuate and bring home the big lie daily, even questioning our local elections officers' integrity, and then voting no to establish some sort of decorum and civility in support of their very own Q Shaman weekly insurgent rally during the Board of Supervisors meeting. My goodness gracious, folks, when is this ridiculous big lie junk going to stop? So without that, sorry for getting a little worked up here. Once again, you can call in 605-4567. And no, we're not going to talk about the big lie, and we're not going to talk about the local militia white nationalists. What we are going to talk about today is what Dr. John Hansen wishes to discuss, and that's basically how wildfire has marshaled to advance corporate and political agendas, most notably at the logging industry's profit. And Dr. Hansen, are you there?
I'm here.
Yes, sir. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. In fact, you know, I just scanned your new book. Is this your first publication, or is this one of many? Called Smokes.
Well, actually, it's my second. My first book was 2015, but that one I co-authored and co-edited. That was called The Ecological Importance of Mixed-Severity Fires, subtitled Nature's Phoenix. And Dr. Dominic Della Sala and I co-edited and co-authored that along with number of other scientists, but this is my first solo book.
Gotcha. And the full title, by the way, is Smokescreen: Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate. And boy, I'll tell you, this is a hot topic. excuse me for that. But, you know, in just kind of thumbing through the book, and I haven't read it in detail, my gosh, this whole concept is just, well, it seems real paradoxical to me. And folks like me who aren't ecologists and haven't studied this, you know, what stands out is, okay, we got climate change happening. I mean, most people will say that's happening, which is affecting our forests. And then consequently, if we follow that circle, we've got bad logging practices and forest management, which is affecting our climate change. And it just kind of is sort of like a feedback loop going on. Am I kind of getting that right?
Yeah, you are, actually. That's a really solid way to say it. I mean, this is one of the things I talk about quite a bit in the Smokescreen book, is the role that logging plays in making climate change worse. And not only making climate change worse, but in most cases, actually, making fires burn hotter and faster, oftentimes towards towns. And yet the dominant management paradigm right now, both in the state of California and at the federal level, is to continue to double down on funding for backcountry logging and backcountry fire suppression, and to basically starve communities that need the funding to become fire safe and be protected from wildfire, and only a drop in the bucket is going towards that. And so we really need to shift direction. We need to protect our forests so they can store more carbon and pull more of that excess CO2 out of the atmosphere, and redirect our funding into a jobs program to create fire-safe communities so that we can be safe and safely coexist with wildfire.
You know, and that's one of the things that came to my mind is there have been proposals, and I do believe currently in one of the Jobs Act's proposals that is addressing infrastructure to do just that, hire thousands of folks to help, I don't know what the word is. When I say harden our communities, that sounds kind of aggressive, but to work on forestation projects to help mitigate dangers of fire. It just seems like that makes an awful lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what they're proposing, and this is the key thing. And I talk about this a lot in the Smokescreen book, is the power of language, and the danger of the misuse of language. You know, right now, we have a lot of very Orwellian euphemisms being used to promote business as usual logging and mismanagement of our forests, and to direct federal resources and state resources into all the wrong things. Things that are making the situation worse for communities, for ecosystems, and for the climate. Yeah. And so it's really important to kind of dig down a little bit and see what these proposals really are. You know, if they're proposals that are actually increasing protection of ecosystems like forests, you know, it's what we call nature-based climate solutions, then also including anything that will increase funding for protection of communities from fire, then that's a good thing. And there are some proposals that would do this. There are also a lot of proposals that are basically Trojan horses. They say, oh, this is about climate resilience. This is about forest health. This is about community protection, or what they call fuel reduction. And really, you know, these are just Orwellian euphemisms, and these are oftentimes really large logging proposals that would direct billions, in some cases tens of billions, of additional taxpayer subsidies to massively increase logging. And in fact, some of these legislative proposals are being spun as reforestation proposals.
And as I understand,
really misleading.
Some of them were actually written by timber industry.
That's right.
Submitted. So, yeah. And but yet, my house was and my whole community was destroyed up here in the Carr Fire, and that was a phenomenal fire. You've probably studied a little bit about that, the fire-nado concept, where it wasn't a typical fire. It was like a tornado fire that devastated our community real quick. And then, of course, in the middle of winter, or at the start of winter down in Butte County, the campfire. And once again, when climate change is happening due to our poor forestry practices, as well as you know, the mitigation that is lacking in protecting our communities, it's just devastating. It's, and so part of you goes, well, okay, thinning, huh? Well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. But yet, in your book, you demonstrate how thinning practices have actually contributed to devastation, which is just sort of a paradox. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, that's a really good way to say it. And a lot of the things that that I talk about in the book, you know, are seemingly counterintuitive until you sort of drill down a little bit and understand it. And this is one of them. The thinning issue is one of them. Yeah. And I'm very familiar with the car fire and the devastation that it caused in the community. I'm very familiar with the camp fire and the devastation that it caused in Paradise and Concal and Magalia and those communities. And it's really, really key. And I speak about these sorts of examples, you know, quite a lot in the Smokescreen book because they are really illustrative of why we need to shift direction. Because the fact is that these human tragedies that are coming from some of these larger wildland fires, these are almost entirely preventable if we shift direction and focus our attention and resources on community safety, on saving homes and lives in communities that are vulnerable to wildland fires. And the reason I say that is this. If we focus on creating more fire-safe structures, simple things like rain gutter guards to keep those dry pine needles and leaves from accumulating in the rain gutters, ember-proof vents so that the flaming embers that are driven by the winds in advance of the flames don't get driven into an attic space through that you know, that old coarse mesh wire vent where an ember can just, you know, float right through or be driven by the winds through. Defensible space pruning of vegetation. Basically a very light touch, removing dry grasses and some shrubs and saplings and lower limbs on mature trees within 60 feet or at most 100 feet of homes. Evacuation assistance for communities, early warning systems when a fire is close by. All these things are incredibly effective, and I talk about numerous examples in the book where, you know, over 95%, in some cases over 99% of the homes survive, and all people get out safely if it's done properly. The problem is we're being told by state and federal agencies and by the logging industry that the solution is to do more vegetation management, more logging out there in the wildlands, and somehow that will stop fire from reaching communities. And the problem is that not only is the science telling us that any vegetation management beyond 100 feet from homes provides no additional benefit, but in addition, when these thinning projects or so-called fuel reduction projects that often involve removing both live and dead trees, when they occur, they typically make fires burn hotter and faster. And in fact, we saw that in Paradise and in the car fire.
And tragically, the car fire was a human accident. You know, it just, and actually, you know, I don't know, I'm not, once again, I'm not an ecologist, but it seems like the Whiskeytown area tried to do a lot of fire mitigation, you know, with prescribed burning and so forth. And yet there, you know, when things aren't rolling our way, like when climate change is making, you know, everything hotter and drier, and you have a human accident, it's just really hard to control. I mean, as we were being evacuated, going out our road, I could see the fire coming, and and the very nice CDF guy, you know, he was very, very, he said, oh, you know, don't worry, we're going to hold this fire, you know. And I looked at him and I smiled and I said, yeah, I don't think so. So the problem, it seems to me, is, I don't know, is it getting worse or have we always had to deal with this, what you call in your book, mega fire type stuff?
Well, we've always had big fires. And in fact, and I talk about this in the book a lot, is that there's a broad consensus among scientists in my field, even when we disagree on other things. There's a broad consensus that we actually have quite a bit less fire in our forests now than we had historically before fire suppression. And the fires historically weren't all small. You know, a lot of them were small. Some of them were medium-sized. And sometimes, you know, maybe 8 or 10 years in a given century, there were, you know, serious drought conditions, and you get those hot, dry, windy conditions, and the fires would become very large. Yeah. You know, so we've always had large fires. That's not unprecedented. What is unprecedented is we have so many people now, far more than we did 40 years ago, that are in harm's way. Yeah. The good news is that we can do something about that. We can actually make homes and communities fire safe, but we have to focus there. And I think you really summed it up really well just a moment ago. The problem is that people are being told by agencies that they trust, state and federal, they're being told by industries that they trust, that they've got them covered. Don't worry about fire. We'll suppress the fire out there so it won't get to the town. We'll stop the fire with these logging projects that we're calling fuel reduction, thinning, post-fire logging, removing dead trees, removing live trees. Somehow removing all of that vegetation equates to removing fuel from the forest. That's what people are being told. It's not true. It's actually the opposite. I'll explain that in a minute. And what happens is two things. People are being given a dangerous false sense of security. That somehow they don't really need to focus so much or take the effort or spend the resources to make their home fire safe and their property fire safe. And because the problem is out there in the wildlands, it'll be solved by agencies and by industries. And what happens is, of course, when you get these hot, dry, windy conditions, these weather-driven fires, they blow right through areas that have been thinned or where there's been post-fire logging. Where there's been prescribed burning. They blow right through that because fires are driven mostly by weather and climate, and therefore climate change. So these vegetation management operations are not stopping fire, and often fire burns faster through those areas.
Yeah, and this fire that I experienced, it was kind of an abnormal, you know, type situation, and I think that's going to be the new normal if things kind of continue. What you're talking about there in your book is the from wildlands approach as opposed to from home out approach, and I think I read where it's kind of been proven that it's the home out approach that that actually helps our communities. The whole concept of wildland fire in from the wildlands is kind of a myth.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, so these two competing approaches. There's the old approach, which is still dominant currently, which is from the wildlands in. And the idea is you focus most on vegetation management, mostly logging, but also chaparral removal, other mostly vegetation removal, tree removal projects, out in remote wildlands, you know, hundreds of meters from home, sometimes, you know, kilometers, miles from homes. And then also on fire suppression out in remote areas, you know, based on this idea that we'll stop the fire.
Yeah.
And the problem is you can't stop a weather-driven fire. And I talk about this in the Smokescreen book. It's like trying to fight the wind. You can't fight the wind with a chainsaw. It doesn't work.
Right.
We have to accept that these are weather-driven, climate-driven events. And the one thing we can do is protect homes. And we can do that very, very effectively. But it's a shift in our thinking. In fact, if you look at what happened, in the car fire, it's true as well. There's been an extensive history of logging, post-fire logging, commercial thinning, on private and public lands, you know, all around, and the area in the previous decades before the car fire. And that didn't stop the car fire. In fact, those areas typically burned more intensely in the car fire. Same thing in the campfire. The first 6 hours of the campfire, between the point of ignition and reaching the town of Paradise, those first fateful 6 hours, that fire burned through several thousand acres that were some of the most heavily logged areas in the entire Sierra Nevada. Intensive post-fire logging on private lands and on national forest lands from a fire that occurred 10 years earlier, commercial thinning, all of it done under the guise of fuel breaks and fuel reduction. And people in the communities were told that that would stop the fire from getting there. In fact, that's where the fire burned most intensely and most rapidly, and people had very little time to evacuate.
So that's where the fires kind of get turbocharged, if you will, with the addition of climate change factors.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, but still, it's kind of a paradox. I have a hard time wrapping my head around. You know, I've hiked in what we used to call virgin woods in virgin parks, and they just look and seem totally different than, going through, a lot of what is the national park or state park system right now. They just look different. They seem to have big trees that are tall and not as much underbrush. Logging, there's no evidence of logging there in most, and not all, cases, but in the virgin timber cases. And you're going, well, gosh, this forest looks thin. I mean, it's like you could, I had a guy that I worked for once who said this. He said, and this guy was pretty old, but he remembered back in the 1920s where you could drive your Model A through the woods. And is that a myth?
No, it's not a myth, actually. And this is, again, something I talk about a lot. There's a lot of science on this now. It's not a myth, but it's only part of the story. And I think that's what's been missing until more recently. The last 10 or 12 years, there's been a real surge of research on this and understanding historical forest structure and fire regimes. And what we understand now is that our forests, historically, before logging and fire suppression, had a mix of fire intensities. That's natural: low intensity, moderate intensity, and high intensity, where low and moderate basically means most of the trees survive. Small trees are killed, some medium-sized trees, some large trees, but not as many, and where high intensity, where most or all of the trees are killed. And it's actually natural to have that mix, and in fact, those patches that burn at high intensity are really rich ecologically. A lot of native species have evolved over millennia to depend on that habitat. We can talk more about that in a bit.
Well, listen,
but the point is that they had a mix of fire intensities. They had a mix of forest densities. Some areas were very open, what they say, open and park-like. We hear that phrase a lot in ponderosa pine and mixed conifer forests in California, for example, and elsewhere in the West. There were some areas that were open and park-like. But the research is telling us that it was typically around 20-25% in most regions that were like that. The rest were moderately dense to very dense, and a significant portion were very dense. So the question is, what does that mean? What does it mean from a fire perspective if you have a really, really mature, dense stand of forest? The dominant assumption out there in society and also in land management agencies, state and federal, and a lot of politicians on both sides of the aisle, the dominant assumption out there is if you have a really dense forest, you have more fuel and it's going to burn much more intensely. Yeah. If it's really dense because it has higher levels of environmental protection from logging or because it hasn't burned in a long time, however it got to be that dense, that is the risk. That's the thing that's driving the large, intense fires.
Well, Dr. Hansen,
and
look,
in fact, what the science is telling us, it's exactly the opposite.
Hold on a second. Hold that thought, because we'll get right back to this on the other side of the aisle. We got to take a real quick 2-minute break. Folks, go ahead and call in if you have questions for Dr. Hansen, and especially if you have questions about fire. We appreciate your phone calls and keep them coming. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
I expected to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
These are unprecedented times, challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency child care, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
I'm Arielle Winter. If you're anything like me, your pets are not only your best friends, they're part of your family. American Humane, which has been rescuing animals like Cleo here for more than 100 years, has life-saving tips that can make a big difference in a disaster. When disaster strikes, you want to protect your whole family, including your pets. To help keep your family safe and help our best friends in their worst times, find tips at AmericanHumane.org.
I expected to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military.
I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to MakeTheConnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
Redding Electric Utility cares about the whole community, and we offer an income-qualified residential energy discount program that can save you up to $400 a year on your energy bill. And once per year, CARES bill credit up to $300. To find out if your income qualifies you for a residential discount program and CARES program, call 339-7200. That number again is 339-7200.
And hey, we're back. Common Ground Radio, and bringing you social, political, and cultural things from the progressive side of the aisle. And this morning we have Dr. Chad Hansen with us talking about wildfire. And Dr. Hansen, just real briefly before we progress into what we can do, what are sustainable solutions that are available? Have you ever read that the book The Big Fire that talked about Idaho, Washington, and what was it? One other state basically involved in a huge fire back in, I think it was around 1915 or something like that, that kind of established the National Forest Service response to fire. Did you ever take a look at that book?
Sure, yeah. The Big Burn by yep. Timothy Egan.
Yes.
And, yeah, and that's actually the name, that's what most people call that fire. Happened in 1910 in the Northern Rockies, and it was a fire that reached almost 3 million acres in size in just a few days. Very, very big, intense fire, very strongly weather-driven, like all the big fires.
Yeah.
And that was the fire that really kicked off this idea in the Forest Service that if they just spend enough money, if they just have enough equipment, they can just stop forest fires.
Yeah.
That was the idea. And honestly, you know, some version of that notion, that myth, still persists today.
Well, in fact, you know, it kind of kicked off. I mean, with Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir and all those folks, that, you know, trying to really bring the concept of ecology into, you know, the national dialogue, whereas before, you know, it was, what's ecology? I mean, we're here, we're supposed to cut trees, and that's what we're going to do. You know, it's there as a crop to be taken and abused, and, you know, so in a way, you know, good intentions, I guess, you know, right? Yeah, the good intention was, we want to save our forests. We've got to have our forests. It's a natural aspect of life and of who we are. But it kind of kicked off this whole war against fire that, and as you demonstrate, and a lot of other people have as well, that we're thinking about that war, if you will, in the wrong way. Maybe fire is not the enemy we think it is, although it causes hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage. You know, it's one of those paradox things, you know.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, we need to think about fire differently out in the forest than we do about fire affecting communities, because they're two very, very different things. You know, interestingly, John Muir, in his writings, he really understood the dynamic value of fire, including patches of high-intensity fire for wildlife and forest renewal and biodiversity. But the origins of the fire suppression program after that 1910 big burn, the real thing driving it was the Forest Service and the logging industry didn't want fires to kill large stands of timber that they wanted to cut down and profit from. Because a lot of these, especially at that time, were in remote areas where it would just take them too long to punch the logging roads in there and clear cut those areas after fires before the trees, the fire killed trees decayed and were no longer usable as lumber. That was really the origin of it. Now, of course, it's morphed in various ways now. But the agency hasn't really, the Forest Service and CAL FIRE, they haven't really entered the 21st century to understand that fire is a natural ecological process, including big mixed-intensity fires. It's not destroying our forests. It creates great wildlife habitat. It cycles nutrients. The forest naturally regenerates. But fire is and can destroy communities. Yeah. And it can cost us many, many homes. It can cost lives. And it that's happening, and that is preventable. But we're going to have to shift direction.
So listen, let's talk about, one of the demonstrations I remember as in my youth was, after Yosemite, they set off a section of Yosemite after one of the big fires there, and said, listen, we're going to let this section burn. We're going to let it do a natural type of response. Was that ever really followed through with the correct intent? Or do we have demonstration projects like that where we are basically letting it do its thing, if you will?
Yeah, we do. We do have examples like that on the national parks and also on some national forests in California and elsewhere in the country. We call that managed wildfire. The other term for it is wildland fire use. And basically what it means is acknowledging that the mixed intensity fire is natural and beneficial in forest ecosystems, and that we actually have too little fire, and then letting more lightning strikes burn without trying to suppress them, especially in the more remote forests that are not close to communities. And there's a broad agreement among ecologists that we need more managed wildfire. And there has been some progress in that direction. Mostly it's been led by the national parks. But on national forests, which have a lot more forest land than the parks, it's been much, much harder to make progress. There's occasional, bold and maverick district rangers or forest supervisors that embrace that more and do more of it, but it's really not being embraced by the brass, by the upper management in the Forest Service, because they want to promote an idea that the solution to fire is to do more logging, remove more trees. That will somehow stop fires, curb fires.
Treat it like
and of
a
course,
crop.
You know, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, the number one thing the U.S. Forest Service does is sell public timber to private logging companies and keep the revenue for its budget. The agency is very, literally in the commercial logging business.
That's how they
like
get their
giant
money.
Logging corporation. And so it creates a financial conflict in terms of the things it proposes. And in my view, and I talk about this in the book, that needs to change.
So, Dr. Hansen, when is the book going to be available for the public? Is it already available?
It's already available. It came out. The official release date was last Tuesday, and so it's available on Amazon. It's available on bookshop.com.
And this is
and
called
also on the website for the publisher, which is University Press Kentucky.
Great.
And
so
again, the title is "Smokescreen: Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate."
And if you're interested in this topic, this is one of those go-to books with a lot of recent data and science. You know, this is not mythology, it's science. And maybe to some people, it's like, wow, this is a little different than what it, because, listen, our area, as you already know, up until 1970, our area was timber. We had, I remember as a youth, back in the 60s and 70s or so forth, we had lots of lumber mills, lots of, and by the way, good paying jobs, union jobs, that brought a lot of our community out of poverty, if you will, provided our community with a huge, so when we change that whole concept, we have to also it's sort of like the Rust Belt, we have to kind of change and make available other opportunities. And I know probably forest ecologists don't think about that, but it is an issue that we do have to think about as our timber industry pretty much came to a halt up here, although I still see a lot of logging trucks. I don't understand.
Yeah, there's
that.
Still a lot of logging, but not as much as occurred in the 1970s, that's for sure. But there's still a lot of logging that happens on both public and private lands. And But you're absolutely right, and some ecologists do think about this. I actually think about it a lot. I've spent a lot of time over the last 25 years thinking about resource economics and thinking about how these things play out in rural economies. And basically, I do talk about this in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that certainly logging has provided jobs over the decades. The problem is that the industry over the decades has automated heavily, so there's not nearly as many jobs for the amount of trees cut, the amount of volume of timber cut as there used to be. It's kind of a boom and bust cycle, so there are times of plenty and then there's a bust. What's interesting is what the current most comprehensive research on resource economics are telling us is that there are far more jobs and far more economic contribution from the recreation economy on our public lands. And in fact, rural counties in the western United States that have higher percentages of protected public forest lands have higher per capita income and lower unemployment rates than counties that have fewer protected public lands.
So they kind of switch.
And so the real gold in the hills, for quite some time now has been, the natural beauty and the scenic, ability. It's really the driver of most rural towns now in the West.
It's getting
and
rarer.
Places in the East as well. Yeah. It's important to keep that in mind because, that's something that we can embrace moving forward, as well as redirecting a lot of the logging subsidies into green jobs that can help create fire-safe communities.
Well, look,
so I'm a big supporter of a just transition.
And that's the only way it's going to happen. Eventually there's going to be some market-based factor involved. And what you're pointing out is so true. There's times when I go to Lassen Park, it's very, very crowded. And there's people international from all over the world there, and it's one of the most beautiful places on earth. And by the way, Reading is really kind of focusing in on that a lot, is the recreational opportunity, because the rest of the stuff is kind of going away, But I, just real quick, I kind of wanted to get your input on what are some sustainable, when we're talking about jobs, my recommendation to a person who was running for assembly up here was, listen, what we have to do is basically expand out the California Youth Conservation Corps and provide opportunities for kids to get out of urban area, learn how to work hard, learn maybe a trade or a profession, learn how to use, equipment. And if we've thought about that, we could provide thousands of inner city jobs as well as rural jobs up here, for folks, for young people that are looking, to get work, to understand what the concept of teamwork is, to understand what the concept of conservation is and make a paycheck and maybe get, some college, afterwards. So what kind of vision do you see in that?
Well, I think that's well said, and I'm a big supporter of jobs programs like that through the Civilian Conservation Corps and expanding that. The one cautionary note is that we are seeing there are a lot of folks who understand that there's value in that, but they're trying to shoehorn decades old logging policies into that concept now, and they're saying, well, we like Civilian Conservation Corps too, so let's allocate billions of dollars of taxpayer money to more logging subsidies and more road building, and we'll do that through the Civilian Conservation Corps. Now, of course, in my view, that would be exactly the wrong thing to do. That would just be doubling down on the mistakes of the past. But there are things that we can and should do by increasing allocations of funding for Civilian Conservation Corps and creating those jobs, both in rural and urban communities, such as helping to create fire-safe communities. I would put that top on the list.
Gotcha.
It's very labor-intensive. It's good work. It's well-paying work, it's sustainable work, and it's really important because it saves homes and it saves lives. And it needs to be done. You need to do the defensible space pruning every single year in communities that are in fire-prone landscapes, which is very common in California and elsewhere in the West as well. And so there's a lot of jobs, a lot of work that needs to be done,
but that's not
where the money's going.
Well,
closing old logging roads and revegetating old landings where past logging damage has essentially deforested, those areas, removing old culverts that are failing and replacing those. there's a lot of good things that need to be done.
Is there anybody doing
that? Areas that could be done if we focus our resources properly.
And is there anybody doing that? Is there any state program or federal program that is trying to, instead of subsidizing the logging industry with that money, trying to get youth employed? And I say this because I did see this as a policy that the Biden administration was including in the infrastructure proposal that they're trying to get passed. We've got to be able to provide those solutions and that makes sense and stop them from getting hijacked, which is the typical, sadly, the typical MO.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and there are, yes, in answer to your question, yes, those programs do exist. And that's the good news. A lot of them didn't exist even in the recent past. The problem is that they're mostly being treated by politicians as lip service. They hold big press conferences and make a lot of speeches about how they're doing this, but when you look at the actual budgetary allocations, it's a tiny fraction of the money that's being allocated, and the great majority is still being allocated for logging projects out in remote forests under the misleading guise of fuel reduction and climate resilience.
What's it going to take
and
to change
what
that?
We need to do is actually shift that.
Yeah.
So the money really is going to communities because that's where it will help.
So you're saying put the money in the community instead of running it through, I think I came across in the book that Governor Newsom is even a little bit guilty in some of this.
He is. Governor Newsom is very guilty of
yes.
this. Governor Newsom has been talking out of both sides of his mouth on this.
Yeah.
He positions himself as a leader on climate change. He talks about climate change as an existential threat, which it is. But the problem is Governor Newsom doesn't apparently really believe that, because he's been approving oil and gas leases and fracking leases left and right. He's been promoting a massive increase in taxpayer subsidies for logging for private and state and federal lands in the state of California in remote forests based on this discredited and disproven idea that will somehow stop weather and climate-driven fires. And so, in fact, in Governor Newsom's current budget, only 3% of his proposed funding for wildlands management, wildlands fire management, is actually only 3% is allocated for protecting communities from wildfires.
Wow, that's
and that's
amazing.
Wrong. I mean, that should be where almost all the money is going, especially after we saw what we saw in the car fire and the campfire.
You know, and what's sad is when the money finally is dispersed out, we get the politicians going, "Hey, I see what I got for you. Here's a
exactly,
few."
Exactly. You know, they're basically throwing out crumbs
yeah.
to communities and expecting them to be grateful. And the thing is that
go ahead.
If we were talking about a situation where, it was pretty rare for homes to burn in fires and pretty rare for people to lose their lives in fires, then maybe you could understand that response to a certain degree. But, in 2018, the campfire claimed 85 lives
yeah,
in paradise,
yeah.
and it burned over 14,000 homes.
And 10 up here.
And, and we saw obviously, serious devastation and loss of homes and lives in the car fire and in other fires.
And
we're seeing a common denominator. We have hot, dry, windy conditions,
yeah.
but we also have, as a key secondary factor, a history of logging.
So once again, folks, this book is called Smokescreen. It's out right now, Debunking Wildfire Myth to Save Our Forests and Climate by Dr. Chad Hansen. This is a valuable read. Google it up, folks. Get it on Amazon or whatever. I don't know about Amazon. I try not to use that.
Yeah, it's on Amazon and bookshop.com.
So we've got a few minutes here, Dr. Hansen. What I heard you say is somehow we got to get the money into the communities, and would that be through block grants to boards of supervisors, or what's the vision on that?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to do it. So sometimes it's routed through federal agencies like FEMA or HUD, and then it's dispersed to counties, to cities, to the state, or it can be allocated directly to counties or cities or the state. Either way is fine as long as the money goes to the right places. So for me, I don't think there's a one size fits all about exactly how it's done, as long as the money goes to the right places for the right things and is being focused on keeping communities safe and saving homes and lives from wildfire. I want to circle back just with the time we have, just briefly, if it's okay with you.
Oh, yeah.
I want to just take 30 seconds and just mention why denser forests don't burn more intensely and why logging typically makes fires burn hotter and faster. Because it is counterintuitive for a lot of folks. But when people, you know, understand it, I think it changes their perception on things.
Yeah.
So if that's all right, I'll just take just 30 seconds and just kind of just go through the quick overview on that.
Yeah. You betcha.
So basically, a dense forest, where it's mature, there's a lot of high density of trees. On the one hand, you would think, well, it's got more fuel because there's more trees and more down logs and things like that. And in a sense, that's true, but it also has countervailing factors. Denser forest has higher canopy cover, and so it's got more cooling shade of that forest canopy cover. And there's less sunlight reaching the forest floor. So the forest, a lot of the understory vegetation, the shrubs, the small trees, start dying back because they're not getting as much sunlight. And so there's oftentimes not as much of it. And you've got a cooler, moister conditions, which has a mitigating effect on fire. Also, the higher density of tree trunks creates like a windbreak effect against the winds that drive the flames in a fire.
Oh, yeah.
And so for all these reasons, denser forests tend to burn less intensely. Interestingly, forests with a lot of dead trees and down logs also burn at similar or lower intensities most of the time. And that seems counterintuitive, too. But the fact is that after trees die, the needles and small twigs quickly fall and decay into soil. And after that, there's just not much to carry flames because fire is driven by kindling-like material, not by large tree trunks. And so when logging happens, it reverses all that. It changes the microclimate to hotter, drier, windier conditions. You have more sunlight reaching the forest floor. You have less canopy cover, less cooling shade, less of a windbreak effect. And the logging creates flammable slash debris and spreads combustible invasive grasses like cheatgrass. And so for all those reasons, typically the fire will burn faster and hotter through those logged areas.
Dr. Hansen, are we able to Google up the John Muir project on, and see what's going on that site as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You can, for more information, you can also, in addition to the smokescreen book, you can check out our website. It's www.johnmuirproject.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that sounds like, so sir, we've got about 2 minutes. You're gonna send us home with something here to remember?
Well, sure. I guess the last thing I would say is that in addition to, you know, obviously shifting direction for communities, for climate, for biodiversity, it's just this. We need to rethink how we view fires out in the forest. You know, we know they can harm communities if we haven't taken steps to protect those communities. But out in the forest, those fires are doing really important beneficial ecological work. And that includes the large fires. That includes the areas where they burn, the patches where they burn hot and kill most or all the trees. We call that snag forest habitat, those areas of standing dead trees. And it turns out, and I have, you know, a lot of material in the book about this, that those areas are comparable to old growth forest in terms of native biodiversity and wildlife abundance. So I tell people that my field is kind of like opposite world. You know, so many of the things that are emerging from the science are very much the opposite of what we might assume.
Or what we've been indoctrinated with, you know.
That's right. Yep.
That's kind of a deal. Well, sir, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk and look forward to diving into this book just a little bit more. And great, it's been great having you.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Okay, sir. We'll talk again soon, maybe.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
So, folks, once again, this is Common Ground Radio, where we present social, political, cultural aspects from the progressive side of the street right here on KCNR Radio. I know that sounds a little counterintuitive, but once again, part of the idea here is that, folks, there's a lot of you that listen that don't get to hear this kind of information. And we've got to have a diversity of information if we're going to figure out how to get out of our problems. So, once again, thank you for listening to Common Ground, and we'll be back next Saturday at 9 o'clock. And you can always go to our Facebook page and take a look, Common Ground Radio. You can leave comments on there and so forth and so on. It's been great having you, and look forward to next weekend.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.